Hey, what does Rick and Morty have anything to do with tarot card readings? You're going to find out in this very special Open Loops episode. And by the way, if you do like Open Loops, before we get going, please make sure to follow this podcast as well as rate the show and leave a review. Ready to enter the multiverse? Let's go. Hello, everybody. Your unconscious mind is tuned in right where it needs to be. I'm Greg Bornstein, and this is Open Loops, Conversations That Bend. Pleasure to have you all today. Now, for those that don't know about me, you might call me a consciousness disruptor. You might call me a cultural hypnotist. But most importantly, you can call me a looper. Yes, because this is the show where we go off into all sorts of different realms of possibility and fantasy. We're talking about the fantastical, the mystical, the supernatural, the paranormal, the overall spiritual, even conspiratorial, perhaps anything that takes us away from waking reality, but might actually be closer to what's happening under the surface every moment of reality, because of just how darn fluid reality actually is. Keep hearing this theme over and over, and that is what we're playing with on this show, as well as answering some of the deepest questions of them all: who and what we really are. Because what is an open loop exactly? You know, this reminds me, when I set out to do this show, I never had the goal of challenging your existing belief systems, but that's what I do now. And the way I do it is by bringing on guests with radically unique ideas, as well as sharing ideas that I'm learning myself. And these concepts, these abstractions, these truths are designed to stimulate your unconscious mind so you can step into the highest version of yourself, because an open loop is just that. It's an unfinished thought. It's an unconscious provocation. It's the thing in your head that just makes you want to know more and more, that infinite curiosity that keeps you going in life. One of the things that I've been infinitely curious about for a long time is the significance of tarot. Some call it tarot. Some call it tarot. Okay, no, they don't call it that. They just call it tarot or tarot. But that's not what I'm curious about. No one's too curious about that. I'm curious about what the significance of these cards are. What is it about these iconic paintings, if you will? You see the art. When I say tarot, doesn't it conjure up something in your head? Can't you see that exact specific card right now you're imagining? I've wondered about it for a long time. Now, today's guest is an expert. He's been doing it for 40 years, more. And look, I was recommended this gentleman by someone from a earlier episode, Ed Hubbard. The episode where we're talking about a certain someone who may or may not be a witch. AOC. Ed the Pagan. Awesome guy. Talked to me a lot about neo-paganism and cyber magic and just a whole lot of wonderfully interesting stuff. And he said, look, I'm one of the teachers and founders of which school, along with this gentleman, Rev. That's because we can abbreviate it now. Reverend Don Lewis. And he's created something called the Infinite Tarot. Very curious concept, very different take on just your traditional 26 major arcana cards, and then you got your minor. No. This is where paralleled universes, this is where infinity gets involved. This is where your soul becomes part of a tarot deck. It's a Kickstarter that more than passed its goal, and a project that, well, you know how when you're playing Cards Against Humanity, which, by the way, Tarot Cards Against Humanity, trademarking that, gotta use that somewhere. There's something there. They have all these expansion packs. They have it with The Sims too, right? Funny how we're talking about the multiverse and The Sims and simulated universe, and whoa, nothing's real, is it? Whew. Imagine a sim playing with a deck of tarot cards called Infinite Tarot. Look, in this world of infinite possibilities and what was it? No Man's Sky? Was that the video game where you could just create universe after universe after universe? Well, Reverend Don's project is very similar. It's a very cool concept. He's going to talk about it in this episode, as well as his upbringing in Corellianism, which is a very interesting form of witchcraft and nativist, pagan tradition. And then practical magic, being a witch in 2021 and teaching people these tools and how that works with technology. Very interesting themes. I really liked the Reverend Don. The way that I dare say I loved his presence. The way he really has a calming, almost, look, I could listen to this guy give a sermon every Sunday, and I know that's not really his message, but I definitely felt, hey, this is a well-spoken, intelligent man of the quote-unquote clergy. A great leader. It was so eloquent, so mind-blowing, too. This is a great time. Without further ado, I don't want to delay this. Here he is, the Reverend Don Lewis, talking about Infinite Tarot. Today on Open Loops, we have the Reverend Donald Lewis, Reverend Don. He is the creator of the Infinite Tarot System, which we're going to get into all of that. He's a psychic, a tarologist, co-founder, and chairman of Witch School, the world's largest school of witchcraft and metaphysics, and the head of the Corellian Church. Don, Reverend Don, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it.
Yes, I love it. I am so intrigued by everything you're doing because, again, in general, I think that things are, there is a narrative. There is a narrative about witchcraft. There is a narrative certainly about psychics and tarot as being this, a different route. If someone says they're into tarot, you automatically think that they're, well, they think a little differently. Perhaps they're anti-establishment, anti-traditional religious establishment. And I'm going, yeah, but look at Reverend Don over here and look at the Wit School with thousands and thousands of people that are interested in these topics. I mean, to completely dismiss this as some fringe New Age phenomena without looking at the history of who we are as a people seems to me to really not give the value that it has given to these different fields of inquiry. Here's my question for you, Reverend Don.
Certainly.
Do you think overall, or I guess let me put it this way, how do you think your work and your involvement in the world of witchcraft, Wicca, and even psychic and tarot arts has changed in recent years compared to where it was when you were even doing it years ago?
I was raised in the Karelian tradition. I have been the first priest of the Karelian tradition since 1979. And so I have a long history in the community. I've been working with tarot cards since even earlier in my life. I've been professionally reading those since the early 1980s. And how has it changed? It's far more mainstream today. It's much more accepted. Even though tarot and, I mean, psychic reading and tarot in particular have been around, well, and witchcraft too, for that matter, for centuries. So there's a level of social acceptance, but then there's also the real level of acceptance. And, I've often seen people who will affect to not socially accept these things, but they're perfectly happy to run to them in secret and get a reading
Oh,
nobody knows about.
yes.
But I think what's changed is thanks to the internet, and people are able to pursue this interest without worrying about what their neighbors think. And I think that for some people, that's very freeing. I don't know if I'd say that that's entirely helpful because it helps people not to be visible in the movement. And visibility is important to movements that are perhaps marginalized, which both witchcraft and psychic reading are. And so the more ordinary people who are seen to be involved, the more other people will accept it. But the fact that you don't have to be publicly seen to be involved has certainly helped to spread it much farther than it formerly was. I think that we saw this really in the 90s when phone line readings became a big thing, the 900 number psychics eviscerated the real-time psychic market. People who did like psychic fairs and home psychic readings found it very hard to compete with the 900 number of psychics, even though they were far more expensive, because it didn't involve being seen going to your psychic. And for some people, that was an issue. I can remember people who would come to me back in the 80s and say, this is against my religion, but, and my answer, as I recall, was, well, if you feel it's against your religion, you probably shouldn't do it. But they wanted to do it. And so it wasn't really against what they believed at all, just against what they thought other people would judge them for. And with the spread of the internet, people don't worry about that so much. They can pursue their interest, and they certainly do. My personal work, if I had to sum up what has defined it, that would be accessibility. I've always been very concerned with the accessibility of these materials, with the accessibility of spiritual teachings, psychic practices, which I consider to converge, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that. Most of the work that I've done in my life has been about getting it out where people can see it, can benefit from it, because I believe, and the tradition that I represent believes, that the more good information you put out in the world, the more likely people are to have better ideas and understandings of these materials. The more people have better understandings, the more they can build a better world, and that's good for everyone. And so I've always been very big about having the doors wide open, at least within responsible parameters. And that's one of the reasons we did Witch School, because so many people at that time, and we're in our 20th year with Witch School, and if we start from when we started to do the online lessons. Actually, we're farther than that because we've been doing it several years before Witch School started. But we're in the 20th year of Witch School. And what we found at that time is that all kinds of people wanted instruction. They wanted to learn, and they couldn't find anyone to teach them. They could buy books, but to find a real-time teacher was very hard. Sometimes they were in areas where they were the only person interested in Wicca or paganism or metaphysics in general. Sometimes they were in places there were lots of people, they just didn't know how to find them. And for a lot of people, they were dealing with issues of disability and mobility problems that prevented them from being able to get out to their real-time community. And through Witch School, we were able to bring good information and community to all of these people who are isolated for these various reasons. And I think the internet has been extraordinarily important in increasing accessibility to metaphysics of all sorts.
Yeah.
And I therefore think it's a very good thing. I occasionally meet people who don't feel that the internet has had a good effect on the community, and I 100% disagree with that. I think it has been a godsend, for want of a better word. It has allowed people to join together, to meet each other who could never have done so before. I'm going to be part of a presentation at the Parliament of the World's Religions in October of this year with our Karelian Peace Prayer. It will be one of the religious observances being presented, but we're going to have people from all over the world throughout the Karelian Church joining us, because we're in we're throughout South America, Africa, parts of Asia, Europe, and we can all come together in a single ceremony today, which would have been unthinkable 40 years ago or even 20 years ago, in the kind of format we can do now. And I think that is a wonderful thing for people that has really widened people's worlds.
Yeah.
It also allows us to compare our experiences in different parts of the world, which can be very different. So I think it's been a very good thing. And
that's
that is the biggest change.
Yeah. I mean, I'm intrigued by the people that critique it, because, and I suppose this is my evolving understanding of what people even mean by the occult.
There is that. It's changed a bit.
Yeah, because and I could be wrong about this. I know people who are in this scene, or at least they have interest in it, and there is this mythologizing of, even if we're going to look at a very pop culture example of manipulating magic with a K, Star Wars, for instance, there is this idea of hierarchy. There is this idea of, well, yes, we're going to put this stuff out to the public, but if you really want to know about the stuff we're doing, if you really want to know about what's the original definition of the occult, the hidden, well, that's not just something you're going to pick up in a book. You're going to have to be in ceremony. You're going to have to be with people there. You're not going to know what's really possible. And I sometimes go, how does that work with an online school that is putting all this out there for thousands and thousands of people? I'm going, how can you translate these sacred practices that really empower the person to have more, I suppose, control over the will of the universe in a way that is very contradictory with a lot of other religions? How can you translate that technologically when it seems that there is a sacredness that doesn't just happen over a Zoom meeting? What is your relationship to that? How would you respond to that critique?
Well, I have several things I'd say to it. The first is, we're very clear in our first degree lessons in particular that you get out of it what you put into it. If you're just going to read it and stop there, you're not going to get very much. You have to do the things that are asked of you, and you have to work with your mentor. And we have mentors who are available to work with the people. So you are having a personal experience as long as you have chosen to have a mentor. Some people only want to read it. That's perfectly fine. Not everyone has to pursue the path to the max, for want of a better way to put it. But we have mentors who help the student. We have a wide community that they can take part in, where they will have interpersonal interaction as much as they really want to have. It's there. But the other thing I would say, having been in this community for a very long time, you ask me what's changed. One of the things that's changed, and it has to do with accessibility, is that a lot of the people who were in the community 40 years ago, all they'd ever done was read books. They hadn't met anyone else. unless they were in certain areas. It was very hard to find the real-time community, at least in the witch world, but I think also in Goetia or any other part of metaphysics. Unless you were lucky enough to be in a certain area, you did not find it. And if you were there, sometimes you still couldn't find it if you didn't know where to look. So I don't know that that represents actually a change. I think that people look on the past with rose-colored glasses. And I would go a little farther and say that the materials that were available then through books, which was often what people actually had to go to, was nowhere near as plentiful as what's available now, even in terms of classic texts, because you could only get the books you could find access to in local bookstores or individual collections. Today, you can find it all. You can find
That's right.
Dozens of grimoires from centuries ago. You can find classical writings. You can find you can find pretty much any reference you want to find, which you couldn't do 40 years ago. It was very much more difficult then, and difficulty does not equal excellence. Difficulty is just difficulty. Actually, applying yourself, learning the material, practicing the material even more is what builds excellence. You have to do the work. And I've known a lot of people over the years who took that view that there was only one way to learn. But if you looked at what they actually were doing, they weren't doing very much.
That's fair. That's very fair. Yeah.
And of course, there were others who were. But those people will do an excellent job no matter what they're pursuing and how they're pursuing it. I think that it's all a matter of what tools that you're using. The internet presents a tool that a student can use. And if the student really wants to learn, they're going to learn. I would say that, well, you know, I would go back to where I started, that you'll get out of it what you put into it, no matter what route you're taking. And, you know, you can go through a real-time teacher and come away with very little if the circumstances were not necessarily in favor of your learning at that time. Either you weren't taking it seriously enough, or the teacher maybe wasn't that good, because they're not all good. My mind is that this is just another way to go. I certainly would not say that learning online is superior to learning in person, but I will say that today, if you're teaching in person and you're not using the resources that are available online, you're shortchanging your students. Because all of this information is at your fingertips. And if you're just using the couple of books that you learned from 20 years ago, there's a lot more out there. I'll tell you an interesting story. It's interesting to me. It might not be interesting to you, but I do Magic TV, magictv.com. And I've done all kinds of interviews with people over the years. And we've also had a number of programs. At one time, we were doing a program with Therese Pendragon, now Therese DeVoe, who is a prominent witch of Salem, Massachusetts. Wonderful person, beautiful artist. And what we were doing was we were highlighting not really her metaphysical teachings, but her artwork. And she happened to have created some costumey pieces for the upcoming Beltane celebration. And we were showing these. And we had someone comment about how terrible it was to mix cosplay with witchcraft, and no self-respecting witch would dress up for a sabbat. And all I can say is, they had taught hundreds of students who would be aghast at the idea. And all I can say is they've taught their students very badly, because they obviously have never gone to a pagan festival, which can be very costumey. And clearly, I've never encountered the Cabot tradition, which is what Madame Therese comes from, which can be very much about pageantry and flamboyant costumes on occasion, certainly at Grand Sabbats. And I bring that up to say that, you know, some people deliberately limit themselves in what they're willing to learn and therefore what they're willing to teach. I believe that you should teach everything. Now, you may recommend certain things over others. You may have the view that certain things are the better way to go. But, you know, if you were to read my books, one of the things I did again and again is I pointed out, now some people do it differently, or some people do it this way, some people do it this way, some people do it this way, because I had been fortunate enough to have a lot of experience in the wider community before I ever started writing the Witch School book series, which is another thing that I did. And I was fortunate enough to have been taught in such a way that I regarded differences as being a fascinating strength, not a weakness or an aberration. And so every time I encountered a technique, I just regarded it as a different way of doing it, some of them more effective than others. But I believe that you should throw all of these things into what you're doing, because not everybody is the same. And a lot of people approach metaphysics as a cookie cutter production. They want everyone to have exactly the same attitudes, personality, and techniques, which is not suitable to the human race, in my opinion. Everyone is different. Something that's been in the news lately that I encountered long ago is the idea that some people can picture things in their mind's eye very easily, and some people can't do it at all. We have helped some of our students to overcome that problem and learn how to visualize when they initially couldn't, often through the process of soul retrieval, which I find a very, very positive, transformative technique. Probably the most transformative technique that I use. But, you know, everyone's...
You're going to have to go more into that. That is soul... I've heard people talk about soul retrieval before. Usually it's coming from the shamanistic framework. Or, there's somebody who... And what is a shaman if not a witch? But this idea of going on some journey, or I'm not well versed enough to know what a shamanistic session would look like, since I've never actually had one, though I've heard about it, read about it, seen people talk about it. I'm curious, what is it that... Well, look, what school of soul retrieval are you coming from? I mean, is this part of this Corellian upbringing? Did they have this tradition?
We have a specific technique of soul retrieval that is similar to shamanic soul retrieval, but also different at the same time.
Interesting.
But it's based on the same idea. And the idea is this, and it's a very common metaphysical idea, often expressed in different ways. And that is that as you go through incarnation, as you go through your life, you can become alienated from your own energy. You can call it soul loss, you can call it blockage. But a lot of people will find, if they look, that they're alienated from a lot of their energy, their natural energy, because of traumas that have happened to them. And sometimes things like limiting belief systems and other ways that they have just shut parts of themselves off. Soul retrieval is one way of reaccessing that energy. It's certainly not the only one. It can also be done through energetic healing. It can be done through many other ways, but it's the one I find easiest to use. And in Corellian soul retrieval, in shamanic soul retrieval, you take a journey into the other world and you look for your lost energy. Usually, I believe in the form of animal guides, for want of a better way to put it. In Corellian soul retrieval, you journey into the other world, but you speak to deity in whatever way deity comes to you. And deity helps you to recover the energy in what I guess I would call more of an energetic manner. But it's the same idea. And it involves healing the part of yourself that has been broken, reclaiming the energy that has been caught in it, releasing the incidents that led to it, because you have to be able to release them in order to regain the energy. Because as long as you're holding on to whatever that blockage is, you can't let go of it. And you cannot untie a knot that you're holding tightly in your hand. So part of soul retrieval, at least from a Corellian point of view, is releasing whatever caused the problem. That doesn't mean that the situation wasn't still a bad situation. When we talk about things like releasing and forgiveness, that doesn't mean that that it was not a trauma that you went through. It means that you need to stop going through it now and reclaim your energy. And I've found it to be something that can be applied to almost any situation with a good result. One of our priestesses had a significant fear of clowns. She was one of those people who totally freaked out over clowns. We used soul retrieval with her, and she no longer has that fear. It's something that can be used to address a phobia or many other things. It can also be used to address past life issues. The best thing about soul retrieval, at least Corellian soul retrieval, is you don't necessarily have to know what caused the problem. It's the problem itself you're addressing. Could be from a past life, but you can approach it from a point of view of, I don't know where it came from, but it's time to heal it. And so I find that to be very helpful. We have, at our Witch School library, we have a booklet that people can download talking about how to do that. So, and it's also in the degree lessons.
That is a fascinating procedure. I mean, what's interesting is that Reverend Don, I'm always going, okay, there are similar things from hypnotherapy. Mm-hmm. There's similar practices in neurolinguistic programming. You could say that, well, this here is using a different belief framework. And I've even had a hypnotist on that says, yeah, that's kind of, you know, the reality tunnel you choose. If you're looking at it through the lens of magic, you're a magician. If you're looking at it from a shaman, you're a shaman. If you're a hypnotist, it's a hypnotist. I'm curious with regard to the way you view the world, Reverend. Mm-hmm. Do you see, when you look at different fields, a neuroscientist explaining why this specific process could lead to suddenly somebody waking up visualization, are you able to adapt different beliefs and say, yeah, that's one framework?
Or absolutely.
Are you secretly going, well, but really it's magic and metaphysics? Because that's what I'm wondering. I mean, at some level, you must, as someone that's well-versed in this, you must, you know, look at the world a certain way and have a, there's a reason you're doing this versus going, you know what, I'm dropping the magic act and I'm going to go all the way towards neuroscience and just say it's that. Why do you hold, yeah, what has kept you going so long and knowing that there are other ways of looking at these same tools with the traditional upbringing and teachings that you're still bestowing on the world?
So there are several questions there.
I asked a lot. The last one. I asked a lot, but yes, thank you.
For me, I think it's mainly the fact it worked for me. And if it worked for me, it will work for other people. I found it helpful in the darkest days of my life. And I've had some dark days during my life. Just because you practice metaphysics doesn't mean nothing bad ever happens to you. But it does mean you have different tools to react to that. And I found that, for example, in the early 90s, I believe 1991, I suffered a catastrophic back injury that left me bedridden for months and recovering for years. If I had not had the tools that I have metaphysically, I don't know if I'd have made it through that. For me, it worked. That doesn't mean that other things don't work too. It doesn't mean that other ways of viewing these things don't work. It just means that I have found this the best way. And I have looked at many of these other things also. And my attitude is that they are different lenses that you can look at reality through. And for some people, they will be a better one. For other people, they will not, because people are very different. In the Corellian tradition, we're very big on the analogy of the diamond. It did not originate with us, to the best of my knowledge, but we're very big on it. And that is the idea that God is like a diamond. It's one energy, but has many facets. But we'd also say that reality, which we would also say, I think, is the same thing, but reality is like a diamond too. How you look at it, the facet that you're looking at, determines your relationship to it, but the reality is far more. I would never think that my way of looking at things is the only way, or even a complete way, because we're always living and growing and developing. And so you can never have perfect knowledge, because there's always more to learn. And who's to say someone else hasn't learned more? What I would say is if I find better ways of looking at things, I add them into my practice and expand my point of view.
Right.
And I think that if you don't do that, you're making a terrible mistake in your life. Because when you find something that works, I don't understand why you wouldn't do it. But I've met people who kind of have this add nothing and take nothing away attitude to their magical practice. And that to me is just stagnation. But it may serve a purpose for them. So I'm not saying they're wrong, but it's not a point of view that I adhere to. I believe that a magical practice, a religious understanding, however you want to approach it, is a constantly evolving and growing thing. And Lady Bitterwind, the former first elder of my tradition, had a saying, which I believe she is a quote from Piers Anthony, but I'm not certain. But I think that's where she got it. But it's the idea that the only good reason to have a priesthood is to stop people from putting limitations on their understanding of the universe. And I very much agree with that point of view. The idea is never to say this is a perfect understanding of how things work, but rather this is our evolving understanding of how things work. And our grandchildren may look at it differently because they hopefully will know more than we. If we look back on where metaphysics was, for example, in the 1920s, it certainly has changed. And I think that's only to be expected. If we look back on where it was, say, in the 1720s, it's changed tremendously. But life changes us. We learn more, we grow, we develop in our ideas. And in my mind, that's exactly what we're supposed to do. It's always supposed to be a growing, developing understanding. And when you find something that works better than what you've already got, you learn from it.
Has there ever been anyone, because you hear about this all the time in Christianity and Judaism, people that break free? I mean, it's a genre on Netflix, this idea of coming out of Orthodox Judaism specifically. I mean, and that makes a lot more sense to me because it's such a restrictive environment, it seems. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, has anybody ever come from, in your experience, this tradition? And I don't just mean they dabbled in the psychic stuff for a few years. I mean, really, they grew up in this tradition, had parents that were witches, people that were really paganistic. Have you ever met anyone that has completely rebelled against it and said, they became a born again Christian? Or,
well, when pagan children rebel in that way, and some of them certainly do, they usually become atheists.
Interesting.
And I've known
never
a few
hear
who...
that enough in the mainstream. It's always people against Christianity, then you become an atheist. It would be interesting to have someone publicly go, you know what, this witchcraft stuff, here's why I don't believe it's real, because of all these scientific materialistic arguments. Mm-hmm. Why do you think
counter
that is?
Because I think children like to differentiate themselves from their parents. And it depends on the relationship. It depends on a lot of other circumstances. And also in a lot of the pagan world, there is an attitude against raising the children in a religion of any sort. They want their children to choose for themselves. That's not the background I come from, although many people in my tradition follow that point of view. But that very often does lead to the children not having any spiritual grounding. And who knows where they're going to end up. But very often they'll end up in the atheist camp because their parents didn't share their views in the first place. I was raised with the idea that it's good to raise children with these ideas, I'm not quite sure how to put it, but they still have their own choice, but you give them a foundation to choose from. You share what you believe, and then they can take it or leave it. But it's no more uncommon for children of pagan parents to end up with different views than their parents had than it is for children of Christian or Jewish parents to end up with different views than their parents had. And it also is not uncommon for them to grow up and have the same views their parents had. That happens as well, because people are people wherever you go and whatever group they belong to.
Yeah, very interesting. And I realize I still am fascinated by this idea that soul retrieval can help you bring back enhance visualization skills. You know, I am curious about it. What do you think is, well, look, let's talk from a spiritual framework, or at least from your belief system. What do you think is going on there in terms of what is lacking spiritually when someone can't do it? And then how does soul retrieval work to bring that sense back?
Well, speaking metaphysically, I would say that if a person has difficulty visualizing, it has to do with blockages probably in the third eye, because that is the center where visualization occurs. And soul retrieval helps to clear those blockages. I was saying earlier that what we do through soul retrieval, you can also do through energetic healing. It's just a different way of approaching it. So when you work with soul retrieval, you don't necessarily know, you don't have to know what caused the blockage. And it may even be that it's simply insufficiently developed, in which case you may have to work with it more. But I have found instances where soul retrieval definitely did help for people to develop the ability to visualize. Now, in our lessons, we also have very specific psychic exercises for people to do. And these develop, for example, the third eye, and should help to develop visualization. I will say one thing I've learned over the years is to not necessarily use the word visualization. If I were rewriting the book today, which I probably will in the next year or so, I think I'd use the word imagine rather than the word visualize, because it can be a stopper for people. Some people think they can't visualize, and they actually can. They just are letting the word stop them by making them think it's more than it is or something different than it is. But other people apparently just really can't do it. But I have found that on occasion, soul retrieval has helped that. I think the exercises help it also. People who cannot see it, however, often can still feel it. And so one of the things that I would do differently today, because I'm a very visual person, I'm an artist. I can't remember a time I didn't know how to visualize. So it was a surprise to me that anyone had trouble with it. Mm-hmm. I was an adult before I realized that. But I found that those people who cannot see it can often still feel it. And that actually is more important anyway.
Yeah.
And so if they're having trouble seeing it, but they can feel the energy, there's not a problem. But if they want to learn to see it, there are techniques of doing that through exercises to develop it. And in some cases through soul retrieval, if there's a blockage of some sort.
Right. No, I mean, look, I'm curious in terms of then what's going on with the Infinite Tarot system, because you also created that,
yes,
which I'm fascinated by, and it speaks to this artistic capability. Here's what I'm wondering. I mean, when it comes to tarot in general, this idea that people can learn to become visual and use it for psychic practices and metaphysical practices, it makes me wonder what people are doing with tarot cards, because I've heard it multiple ways, and I'm curious what your take on is this. Some people are psychic and they use tarot as the tool. I've heard someone, I had a reading with a young lady many years ago, not many years ago, probably about 5 years ago. Feels like many though. and she said, look, I'm not a psychic at all. I don't consider myself psychic. However, when these cards come out and I'm reading them and interpreting them for people, all of a sudden I get access to knowledge that I don't normally have. And I'm going, well, okay. So what is it? What is it with tarot? And not that it can't be more than one thing, but I'm curious, as you think it's traditionally, I hesitate to use the word supposed, because even that's limiting it. I'll start here. We'll make it very simple. What do you think the tarot is, and how do you feel it is most effectively used?
Well, the first thing I would say is that different people look at it different ways. So I will be presenting my own point of view. I consider it an aid to psychic ability. The young lady you mentioned, she might not consider herself psychic, but I would consider what she's doing to be psychic. Obviously, we're perhaps using the word in different ways. In my mind, psychic, the word psychic and the word magic both describe the same energies, but magic is active where psychic is passive. When we do psychic things, we're receiving spiritual energy. When we do magical things, we're sending it forth.
Interesting.
And I believe that we do both of these constantly in an unconscious way. When we learn metaphysics, we're just learning to take conscious control of what are natural abilities. Some people perhaps have difficulty coping with the idea of being psychic, and they want to rely on external things as their explanation of why these things happen. But I would say it's very much a matter of her personal anyone's personal connection to spirit and ability to receive these messages. What tarot cards do, one of the things they do is they relax your conscious mind enough to allow those spiritual messages to come through. Because the conscious mind is the biggest thing that's going to block a spiritual message. They can also be very, for some people, the artwork itself is a big part of what they're doing. The artwork is inspiring them, but that also is allowing that energy to flow. So I would say what happens when you read tarot cards is that really you're just allowing spirit to speak through you, sometimes in ways that are more obvious to the person doing the reading, sometimes in ways that may not be as obvious, but that's what's happening. It is a psychic skill. And for different people, it can take different forms. Some people are very dependent on the deck that they're using, and they'll have different experiences with different decks. I have not normally found that to be the case for myself. Some people, their decks will be, they'll have a strong personality, for want of a better way to put it. I have not normally found that the case in my experience. I think it's a matter of your relationship with the deck and your relationship with spirit. I don't think tarot cards, well, you know, maybe it's just how I use them, because I tend to be very much about accessibility and doing things in a simple, straightforward way. And my tarot cards always do the same. If I were a more dramatic person, they might be more dramatic. I will, however, mention just last night I was doing readings with the Infinite Tarot, which involved taking the base tarot, and I guess we'll talk about that in a moment, and adding in the expansion decks. And I'll show them while we're speaking.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is the Tarot of Hecate, which is the base deck of the Infinite Tarot. It was originally created back in the 1980s as a black and white deck. It came out as a color deck in the early 2000s. And it is the base that we build the Infinite Tarot on. And then we have these expansion decks, such as our astrology expansion deck, which has the Ptolemaic, well, it has all the planets and the signs, and you would read them according to their qualities. And we have a numerology deck, which is right here, which has the numbers, and you would read them by numerology. The numerological meaning of the numbers, we have the Shengzhou expansion deck, which is Asian astrology. We have the nine muses. We have the runes.
Oh, yes.
And so we have all these different expansion decks and others that are planned for the future. We also have the Corellian Ancestor deck, which is here. And I guess this is the Ancestor. Oh, Lady Bitterwind, we were talking about her earlier. But this is not part of the Kickstarter, but it is available at CorellianPublishing.com. But so last night I was doing readings describing the system, and I started with just the Tarot of Hecate, then I added in the astrology, then I added in the numerology. And what was interesting is that reading after reading, it was an hour long session, although only a part of it was broadcast. But reading after reading, we kept getting the astrology cards and some of the numerology cards, despite the fact that the Tarot of Hecate has 100 traditional tarot, well, 78 traditional tarot cards plus additional ones to the number of 100, and it wasn't being represented in the readings. And I would shuffle the deck, I would pull from different parts of the deck, but I was getting those particular cards because that's what they wanted to give me. So decks do have a bit of a will of their own. Certainly spirit has a will of its own and what it's going to give you. And I was taught that when you do a reading for a person, you have to take what you're given because that's what they're supposed to have, even if it doesn't make sense to you. And I've often had situations where I did a reading for a person that made no sense for me, but then they said, yes, that's exactly right. And that actually some of the ones last night were kind of that way. After all these years, I know that happens. And the other thing I was taught is if you're in a place where you're doing public readings and anyone can come, you take whoever comes. The people who are coming are meant to come, and they're meant to have the experience that you can offer them. And so I believe it's very much a spiritual exercise and very much guided by spirit, both in terms of who will get a reading and what they will be told. And also, you know, what you as the reader tell the person isn't always what they hear. They will filter it through their own understanding and sometimes through their hopes or fears. And so you try to be as clear as you can, but some people will be more receptive than others. But that is not something you can control.
Yeah.
But with the Infinite Tarot, and you can learn more about Infinite Tarot at tarotai.com.
Yeah, we'll put the link to that for everybody. It's very fascinating stuff.
Again, it starts with Tarot of Hecate. The Tarot of Hecate, as I say, was originally designed in the 1980s. Lady Bitterwind was kind of the moving force behind it. At that time, I had been illustrating in the science fiction world for several years, and I was also illustrating in the pagan world for, at one point, 90 different pagan magazines. And Lady Bitterwind kept saying, you know, this artwork should be tarot cards. It's full of symbolism. It's compelling. You need to make a tarot deck. And I said no, because I didn't want to do this unless I had something original to say about it. And then she supplied me with something original, which was the change in numerology. She was very inspired by the works of Piers Anthony, which I can't say that I've personally read, but what I know about it, I got from her. But what we did is we added an extra suit, the suit of lamps, so that we had five minor arcana suits instead of four. And the suit of lamps deals particularly and expressly with spirituality. And then we added a number of major arcana cards, the magic card, the soul, body, and mind cards, and the time, past, and future cards, which brought the total number of the deck up to 100 cards, which she considered to be perfect numerologically. And that was the original nascence of the idea of the Infinite Tarot, of expanding on the tarot deck. Then later, I met Edward. We were talking about Edward earlier, I believe, and Edward had a technique called Destiny's Design that he used for reading Ed Hubbard. And this involved using many different tarot decks together in the same reading. And it led kind of naturally to the idea that if you're going to expand your tarot deck, why not make them so they all fit perfectly together and bring in all these different influences you can use? The other thing is that as a Corellian, we have the teaching that tarot is a visual scripture of the soul's journey through incarnation. But over the years, our views of incarnation have embraced a very broad attitude regarding the multiverse, dimensionality, etc. And by expanding the tarot in this way, we're much more clearly reflecting the actual multiverse. What a person can do with the Infinite Tarot is they customize it to their own use. They take out cards that perhaps don't resonate to them as much, and they put in others that do. So, for example, if numerology was your specialty, adding the numerology cards would be a great help to you. If astrology was something you had a strong interest in, that might be a great help to you, or runes, or any of the various different expansion decks. And so you can add to it to make it uniquely your own. You can subtract from it to make it uniquely your own. And we also have a create a card option at the Kickstarter, where you can have a card made that is only yours. It can be a card depicting you as perhaps a part of the major arcana, or it can be any card that you would like to have created that you haven't found. And in this way, you can make a deck that nobody else has. And I think that's very helpful. One of the things I've found about tarot is that, well, not just about tarot, about psychic reading in general, is that you have to have the language to convey the message. When you get a psychic message, it comes in as energy through your crown chakra, down through the third eye, and out through the throat chakra, usually. But it's pure telepathy. There are no words. There's only concepts. In order to make that message, the energy has to take the words out of your brain. And to do that effectively, they have to be there. So the more that you can express yourself, the more that spirit can express itself through you. And I would say it's the same with the tarot. The more different symbols you have available, the more different, more individual the messages you can bring through. And for some people, they're going to resonate much more to, for example, astrological stimuli than necessarily the traditional tarot. So the idea is that just like our journey through incarnation is unique to us, and no other being is going to have exactly the same journey, so too your tarot can be unique to you, and no other person necessarily will have the same one, because your skills, your understandings, your way of relating to spirit are unique. And so that's the idea behind the Infinite Tarot.
Yeah, I know that when you go to the website, tarotai.com, when you start talking about the multiverse, I'm going, whoa, this is getting... We're starting to get into some... I often think when people are talking about the multiverse now, they're usually... If you're not Neil deGrasse Tyson... And you're not, you're probably talking about a lot of the metaphysical and consciousness expanding frameworks that we have. People that love talking about quantum physics and mm-hmm. where that overlaps with spirituality really lean into the multiverse. I've never heard it in the context, though, of tarot. And I certainly have never heard someone that is well-versed in pagan tradition speak about the multiverse. Where did that word first come into your life? Why do you embrace it?
Oh, goodness. Well, the concept came long before the word. It was part of my training back in the 70s. And it was part of the third degree training specifically. It's still part of our third degree training. And we talk about things like parallel lives, similar lives, the way that the soul propagates itself, which is very much like everything else in nature. It goes along in a straight line and then it splits. And it goes along in a straight line and it splits again. And so if you're doing past life work and you go back up that chain, you will find at a certain point you have the same past lives as other people who came from that same line. And they are also part of the same soul, because the soul has many different expressions. There's a lot of underpinning to that that we don't really have time to go through, but that's the Corellian concept, that if you look at the map of a river, the map of a tree branch, the map of the veins in the human body, they all look pretty much the same. And we believe that the map of the soul is the same. And part of this has to do with dimensionality, that the soul, being complex, can have multiple incarnations at the same moment. And that can be in this dimension, and you can meet yourself. If you're open to realizing it, it will be plain to you. But also in other versions of this reality, and that there are other versions. The explanation I like best came from, of all things, the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, and, yes.
The multi-lane highway of time. And you can change those lanes at will. And I would say that unconsciously, people do this all the time. They move from one timeline to another. But they never know it, because they're not aware of these ideas. They may notice what they might think is a glitch in the matrix, quote unquote, but they don't realize what they've done is change timelines. But when you know you can do it and you learn how to do it, you can do it at will, and it can make significant differences in your experience of your incarnation. It's something that I think should be done with care, certainly. And you know, people love to talk about the dangers of metaphysics, and I'm not a great believer in that. But one danger that is there when you get into the higher concepts of metaphysics is losing your place in reality. Because what you learn is that reality is not nearly as hard and fast as we think it is. It's very fluid. That can be very challenging to a person's self-image if they're not well-grounded. So I think that it's very important when you start working with things like multidimensionality that you are well-grounded and have a strong sense of yourself. You've done your shadow work before you get there, so that it doesn't cause you internal problems. Because when you realize that A does not always lead to B, that A can lead to unexpected other places by working with things like time magic and multidimensionality, because neither time nor space, again, are as solid as they look. That, again, that can be challenging to your place in reality. So you must be prepared for it before you get there. That's why it's in third degree, not in first degree.
Holy moly. Losing yourself in reality. What is that? I mean, I'm trying to imagine what that looks like. Is that, are we talking psychotic breaks, schizophrenia?
Basically, yes. I've had people who say that they came to that, from doing metaphysical things before they had a true understanding of it. But the thing that I would emphasize is it's very deep metaphysics that will bring you there. What, magic, for example, won't normally cause that, the practice of magic, until you realize its actual scope. But hopefully by the time you get there, you're ready for it. But when you realize that you can use energy to affect the physical universe, that will unravel part of what most people think the physical universe is like. It's pulling at a thread. You have to be grounded before you start pulling those threads, because the truth is that it's all very fluid. And if you are not sure of who you are, you're not sure of your chosen place in reality, unraveling reality can be a bit of a challenge. When you realize that you can do something like changing your timeline, when you realize that things like time magic are actually possible, it can challenge a person's concept of what they think the world is. And there used to be a rule in certain branches of Kabbalah that you had to be at least 40 years old, married with children, before you could study it. The reason being that you are grounded in the physical world. I don't agree with that rule, but I do agree with the concept. When you start dealing with existential metaphysics, you need to be grounded. It's very important. It's the only thing that I really would say to people. With those things, you want to go slowly, make sure you've built a strong foundation, make sure you're strong in yourself, because they are real and these things do work. And, you know, I've known people who, when they actually successfully used magic for the first time, or they tried astral projection for the first time, scared the pants off themselves, because up until that moment, yeah, they didn't really believe it. When they found out, yes, it's really true, it challenged their sense of self. So when you go into this, you need to realize, yes, it is real. Yes, these things do happen, and you need to be grounded. So in our lessons in Corellian traditional teachings, grounding is very important. And one of the things that shocked me as I got out farther into the wider metaphysical world was how few traditions actually teach how important grounding really is. Years ago, I worked for a psychic fair circuit called the DNH circuit in central Illinois. Many of the readers were spiritualists, others were New Age, and a handful of us were pagan. But some of those readers, and I'm certainly not going to indicate any particular people, but they were not walking on the ground. They were like 3 feet off of it, totally disconnected from practical reality. And you could often tell, I used to have a phrase, glassy-eyed dead psychics, because they had so overloaded themselves with energy and never cleansed it, never grounded it, that they had fried themselves. And you totally can do that. But something as simple as grounding, which is the simplest metaphysical thing you can do, totally avoids it. Most things people are afraid of in metaphysics can be solved through grounding energy. But you have to have someone who can tell you that, or you never know.
This is mind-blowing stuff. I think it is because you're so grounded that I'm more mind-blown by it. Just listening to you and taking it in, I'm going, oh, this is a really, this is an extensive area of study. You cannot just... And it's out there. I mean, I've fallen prey.
Oh, yes.
I believe that, you know, I believe there are people out there that believe that after they've taken a 6-week online course with someone that is a soul-based entrepreneur that can teach them how to use their psychic intuition, that all of a sudden they think they have this, they're now a light worker. I see it. I believe they think it's real. I'm not sure. But I'm going, wow, to speak to you, Reverend Don, and really talk about this stuff in a way that feels... I feel the weight of its power.
Well, thank you.
In the possibilities of it, adds legitimacy to my skeptical view of life, but B, it makes me go, wow, there is, I mean, you could study this stuff for years and still learn about a new area of magic that you may,
absolutely.
I mean, do you feel there are areas... psychic powers, things that you're like, yeah, I don't even, there's so much more I could do and be tapped into.
Always. No matter how long you're in metaphysics, no matter how hard you study, there's always more to learn. You cannot learn it all in one lifetime. I don't know if you can learn it all in 100 lifetimes.
Wow.
Because one reason is that what happens to us sometimes is we learn something, but we only learn one aspect. I encountered this years ago in doing shadow work back in the 1980s. I thought I had healed certain things, but they were still bothering me. And when I looked at it again with the help of my teacher, Lady Crystal, I realized I had healed the intellectual part, but not addressed the emotional part. When we talk about any of these skills, there are many different levels. And sometimes the thing that you still have to learn is other levels of what you already know. And other times, you just can't see what's there to be learned. One of the concepts I was taught back in the 70s, in terms of the idea of the planes of existence, is that you can see what exists on the plane you're on, and maybe a little bit into the next one. But things that are in higher planes than you personally are simply invisible to you. You haven't learned to see them. Whereas the things in the planes that are lower than you are all around you. And that all of it is effectively simultaneous, but the veil which exists between ourselves and the higher planes obscures it. As we work with metaphysics, we move that veil, we see more, but there's always more to be seen. And if you think about it, how can the human mind ever really understand everything the soul can understand with all of its incarnations? Obviously, there's always going to be more to learn, including when we've passed on from this incarnation. Even this path of incarnation, there'll be more to learn as a soul. I believe there's always more to learn, and that existence itself is about learning and experiencing everything. And, you know, what's right and what's wrong in terms of how to look at things, I think the truth is there are many perspectives, and the soul needs all of them. And so we pass through them through our many incarnations.
Yeah. Do you think that with Infinite Tarot, I mean, on one level, I'm going, yeah, it's kind of cool to have a customizable deck that helps you out. On another level, I'm going, yeah, but also people are, I'm curious what you, I suppose what it is that, yeah, my brain is jumping around so much, but this always happens. If you just had a traditional deck, a tarot card deck, you could spend decades learning how to level up your skills when it comes to delivering a reading. You could, the thing that the person is giving you when you're reading it automatically influences change where you personally are in your journey, whether that's psychically or in your, whether waking life, or if those are the same thing, which they probably are. It's, you're going to be bringing something new to the table, and then you add the spreads, and then you add the numerology, and you add the astrology, but it still could be the same deck that traditional, I mean, I'm just thinking the traditional rider, you know, back of the bookstore occult section, you want to pick up a tarot card deck, here's the one you use. You could still bring that. What do you think that having a customizable deck that is a representation of, And let's be real here, a temporary incarnation of where you're at, because they could go right now, get this deck, customize it to them, and it's not even their full self, given that, I mean, obviously you could keep getting new decks and new incarnations, but what do you think it is about capturing your own soul at this moment as a tarot card practitioner that enhances the experience rather than just spending years studying with a popular deck?
Well, I have a couple of different answers to that. The first one is based in artwork. As an artist, I do a lot of black and white work, and it's very good work. It's a very good technique to use, I mean. But I also do a lot of color work. And there is so much more that you can do with color, but also so much you can do with black and white. They're both valid. But my attitude is, why not add more tools? I mentioned the Tarot of Hecate started out black and white. And if you look at one of the cards, you can see that it's relatively dark because there are heavy shadows that were part of the black and white work. And then we used color to bring it forward. It wasn't because the black and white was not good, but because we felt the color gave it much more emotional quality to the cards. What I would say is that adding these things gives it stronger emotional connection to what you're doing, which makes a stronger psychic connection. It's a matter of adding tools. It's not saying the original tool wasn't good enough. In fact, we also do have a technique for taking our 100-card Tarot of Hecate and making it into a traditional 78-card deck, because some people prefer that. There's nothing wrong with that. But the other thing that I would say about the Infinite Tarot is that it's both an evolution of tarot and going back to its roots. Because tarot, as far as anyone can show, arose in the Renaissance courts of Italy. And early tarot decks were made to order for their patrons. And they were not our 78-card deck that we're all so familiar with. Many of those same cards were present already, but they would include whatever the patron wanted that made it more suitable to their point of view. The nine muses were a common thing that was added, the seven virtues, the astrological signs and planets, the actual things we've added into Infinite Tarot were often added into those early tarots, which often had far more than 78 cards. So in a way, it's getting back to the origins of tarot, where they did make it to the personal specifications of the person who was going to have that deck. But I think that by doing that, by adding these extra tools, particularly when they speak to strengths that the person has, I think that it simply expands the experience. And you know, as you say, you can spend a lifetime studying the 78-card deck and never get everything out of it. But you can also spend a lifetime studying the playing card deck, which is also used for divination, and never get everything out of that. And in some cases, you can spend a lifetime studying a single card and just continue expanding upon your knowledge of it. It's all a matter of where you will choose to put your focus. And I think in the fullness of time, our souls do all of these things. But from the point of view of Infinite Tarot, my attitude is that you're simply adding tools. Going back to the art reference, it's like adding colors to your paint box. It gives you a wider range that you can cover in more different ways. But it doesn't mean that the more limited paint box isn't also good. It just is an expansion. And so I certainly am not suggesting that traditional tarot is in any way bad, but I think that expanding it has a lot to offer. I've certainly found it very helpful for myself.
Yeah. That I love it, and
thank you.
What's amazing is that you're very welcome. I mean, I think the graphics are beautiful already.
Thank you.
If everybody has to check this out, and what's interesting is that at least at the time of this, I mean, when this episode's going to come out, it's going to be around close to 20 days left for this particular project, though. The Infinite Tarot. It has a bit of an eternal quality, so it's not going
away. Oh, that's true.
So it'll still be around. But that said, what's also amazing is that you had this goal of $5,000. You mm-hmm. exceeded it.
Yes.
You know, what is, can you speak more about this initiative to get it out there and what you're hoping to achieve, especially now in light of the fact that, yeah, you've already surpassed the original goal?
What we really want to do is be able to get it in stores. We want to be able to produce it in quantity. We want to be able to have the appropriate codes on the boxes so the stores will accept it, and to get it out into the mainstream world. And again, it's a matter of accessibility. We can sell it all day long on our own little website, but we'll only get to so many people. But if we can get it into physical stores, particularly metaphysical stores, and also in some cases, stores that just have a metaphysical section, far more people may be able to be exposed to it, may find that it's helpful for them. And that really is my goal in why we're doing.
Yeah, I definitely hope you achieve it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Also, I need to ask, Bitterwind Smith,
Yes.
is that a real name?
No, that was her chosen name. Her name was Virginia Smith,
Okay.
but she was born on February 2nd of 1945. And her attitude was that Bitterwind was the perfect name for someone born on that date in central Illinois.
Wow. I
So
know it's so great. It's so witchy. It's so, I mean, it's the perfect I don't know if J.K. Rowling could have come up with a better but yeah, Bitterwind Smith, I love it.
what was really interesting is that she was a lovely, cheerful, interesting, iconoclastic person. And Bitterwind, although I could never think of her under any other name, there was nothing bitter about her. She was a lovely person, but she loved
Yes.
that name.
I know it's a great name. It really is. What do you think it is about these cards? I mean, you were mentioning the history of them, that people commissioned when, as part of their purchase, they would want something that directly was customizable to their situation. I mean, is it was it back then that people just art spoke to the subconscious part of people, and they were more in tune with the use of the visual as a means of accessing their soul. What do you think it was about that somebody said, "Hey, we had a deck of cards that could help di with divining. It would be even better than just tea leaves and looking into someone's eyes and telling them their fortune directly." I mean, I'm curious, what is the enduring quality of the cards, in your opinion?
I do think the artwork is a very important aspect. And what happens with artwork is it bypasses the thinking mind, or it can. It goes directly to the soul. In the first degree book, I have a passage talking about allegory and why it's so important, that in pagan religions, we use symbolism and artwork and images far more than we use the written word, which is more typical of certain other religions. And there's a reason for this, and the reason is what I just said. The artwork speaks to the soul more than just the mind. You can look at an artwork and you'll almost immediately have a feeling from it. And you can find all kinds of levels of meaning in it that you could never just put in a paragraph of words. You can make something far more complex visually. So I think that artwork, as in the cards, for example, does work much better with the higher self. It works with the soul. And if you look at different forms of divination, the vast majority of them are visual, in terms of what they work with. Not all of them, certainly, but a very large number of them. And I think it's for that reason. Now, of course, to just sit down and do a clairvoyant reading for a person is a wonderful thing, but some people have to work up to that. I think that it certainly is a wonderful thing to do that. And in fact, I do clairvoyant readings. But back when I was working in the fair circuit 30 years ago, one of the things that we talked about was the idea that people like to see something when they're getting a reading, because a number of the people who read in the fair circuit could do clairvoyant readings. And even if they were using cards, you might actually be getting a clairvoyant reading. But when you have something that you can lay down in front of the person who's asking the question and say, "Now you see what this card says. This is why we're going here. Look at the picture." It's very helpful to the person who is the querent to have that. Not everyone, but different people are different. And if, for example, I were to draw this card, it would give you a feeling very different from, for example, this card. Most people would have a different reaction to each of these, which would help them to understand what was being discussed. For the reader, they're interacting with their higher self. For the client, it's helping them to see the process as it's occurring. So I think that from the point of view of the client or the querent, cards have a value at that level. It helps them helps to give them something to hold on to, because particularly if they don't have a background in metaphysics, They may not really understand what's happening. And I think it helps to see how the pathway is unfolding. It depends on the person, of course.
Yeah, I mean, you forgive my ignorance for a second, but Reverend Don, but I'm curious, even when it comes to these archetypal things, I guess the suits on the tarot card, the Pentacle of Swords, and then you have the Magician card, and the Two of Cups, all that stuff. Did that come from something traditional? Were those archetypes, or and suits, if you will, already in Hermeticism, and they were just transferred to the card? Or did one person come up with it? What are the origins of what you traditionally see on tarot?
Well, cards originated in China and they moved westward. They came through India, they came through the Middle East, and then finally, around in the 14th century, they came to Europe. It's not really clear how they got there. They may have been brought by the Romani people, they may have been brought by returning crusaders, but they were being used all through the Middle East. And they were playing cards, very much like modern playing cards, but with different suits than, for example, English playing cards. Even today, playing cards in different countries will still sometimes have different suits. The ones that you see on traditional tarot cards were defined, well, really right there at the beginning, and in the Renaissance courts of Italy, and probably do reflect ceremonial practice. But if you study the history of tarot cards, the suits vary in different times and places. One of the most interesting things was during the French Revolution. When they wanted to get rid of all symbols of monarchy, that had an interesting effect on tarot cards. The court cards had to totally change. A lot of the symbolism had to change. But there are some fascinating books on the history of tarot that will tell you about things like that and how tarot has been different in different generations. But as to the choice of the suits in a modern tarot, usually it's wands, swords, pentacles and cups. And these are related to metaphysics. They come out of ceremonial practice. They come out of Goetia, for example, and they were parts of a magical altar. Most of these are very important in modern Wicca, but I would not say that is the origin of the symbols in the tarot. But it is a synchronicity. But more, it has more, I think, to do with ceremonial magic, which was certainly very big in Renaissance Italy. And one of the things about tarot that people forget is tarot is also used for just ordinary playing cards. Throughout Europe, the game of Taroc or Tarocchi was used with tarot cards and is still a very popular game that people play and don't use them for divination. They were used for divination in the same sense that that what we would think of as ordinary playing cards were also used for divination. And that is similar to the way that dice, which were used commonly used for gambling, were also used for divination. And people just have a way of adapting these systems. And the reason that makes them good for divination is that they're random. And the idea is that spirit will control what comes to you according to what you need. And all of these different systems can be used in that way, and many others besides. The thing that is almost well, that is pretty universal in divination is the random character of how it occurs. Even in astrology, which is totally governed by mathematics, the moment of your birth is still random. And so it's believed that there is no random activity in the universe. It's all spirit. And this goes back to the Hermetic idea of as above, so below, that spirit will be reflected in ordinary random things in your life. And in the first degree lessons that I've referred to a few times, I talk about that and how anything can be used for divination as long as you're clear on how you're understanding it. Spirit will use it as a way to speak to you. Divination in the end is just a language that you use to communicate with spirit and allow spirit to communicate with you. And it can be whatever you want it to be. It can be whatever you choose for it to be. And in some cases, it can be totally eccentric. Reading Bones is a good example. I don't know if you're familiar with Reading the Bones, but the bones usually are not actually bones. They're trinkets that the reader has collected and they keep in a bag or a box. And the querent will draw a certain number of them to be read from. And the reader will go by what the different trinkets are. But what comes up is totally random depending on what the person pulls out of the bag. And this can be a very effective way of reading, very unstructured. And because reading doesn't have to be structured, it just has to be clear in terms of what spirit has available to use. This is how people in the past often read the flight of birds or they read the shape of clouds. They would read the path of smoke from a candle or from incense. All of these things can be read. Most interesting form of divination I've ever heard about was the doll lady. And at J&M Fairs, before I started working there, the doll lady had been one of the star psychics. But she was an elderly lady and eventually retired before I got there. So I never saw it, but I was told about it. And she had this table full of dolls, all kinds of different random dolls. And she would ask clients to pick six of them. And she knew the order that they were being picked in, but she didn't tell the client. But one, for example, might be about emotion, one might be about finances, etc. And she would read them according to the dolls they picked by the symbolism of the costumes, for example. And people loved this, and it was very accurate for them. But it was a very idiosyncratic way of reading. And as far as I know, this one person is the only person who did it. But for her, it was the perfect system. And because she had that interest, and it really helped her to tie into her connection with spirit. And that's really what reading is all about.
It makes me wonder how much you need to marinate the items in spirituality because, and here's what I mean. Some people say, I mean, I've seen it happen, and it sometimes I'm wondering if it's just part of the entertainment side of it when they bring out the tarot card, it's in there. It's in their little sack, and then they open it up and slowly remove the cards, and then it's, you know, you're not supposed, you have to interact with it. It's certainly a traditional thing. I mean,
It is.
it's the Torah. That's what I had to do with my bar mitzvah. I mean, you know, you open this ark, you're not allowed to touch it. You have to use this, you know, you can't, you have to use a pointer, for lack of a better word. I mean, it's interesting that I'm curious what your take is on, because from what I've heard you say, look, you seem very accepting, Reverend Donna, of the way people do different traditions. What is your stance on the item versus being sacred versus the person bringing that level of sacredness to the object? And how do those relate? Because I don't know, sometimes I think people are a little too precious with their items, but at the same time, if this has a high vibrational spirituality, I also wouldn't want it to get lost in customs. So yeah, what is your take on that?
My personal view is it's all on the person and their relationship with spirit. But some people's relationship with spirit requires a great deal of ritual. And if that's what is good for the person, that's what they should do. In my lessons on tarot, where I've written, I put this under the heading of superstitions about tarot. Some people will say that you must keep your tarot card in a silk scarf. You should have a special box. My tarot cards are lucky if they have a baggie. In the days when I was going to psychic fairs, sometimes they'd be in a pouch, but it wasn't uncommon to be in a baggie. And you know, some people say, "Oh, nobody else can ever touch my cards. Anyone can touch my cards," because I know how to clear energy. And I will clear the cards before I use them. So,
That makes sense to me.
and when reading for a person, I want their energy on the cards because they're who I'm reading, and then I'll clear it when I'm done. That to me, that's how the cards get to know you and pick up on you. But it's not absolutely necessary because you can read for someone on the other side of the world. But when I'm with a person, I usually like them to shuffle the cards. But in my mind, all of these things, and some people, of course, have these very particular cards who will only speak on certain occasions and must be handled with such care. And I think that's a reflection of the person more than a reflection of the cards. It's what they need. And there's nothing wrong with that. Now I'll give you an example based in what we might call straight psychic reading. A lady that I used to know, I will not give her name, but she's representative of many people. When she worked with her spirit guides, they were very severe with her. They were always saying, you must do so and so, and why have you waited, and blah, blah, blah. My spirit guides are very friendly. They're very humorous. They're fun to work with. Hers, right. Hers just made me roll my eyes. But then I realized this was her personality. She needed them to ride herd over her. It was part of her individual relationship with spirit and her spirit guides. The spirits themselves were probably nowhere near so severe, but they knew it's what she expected of them and what she needed from them to keep her in line. So I can't criticize it, but it's not inherent to the experience. And it's the same with cards. Someone may need their cards to be highly ritualized. Someone may need their cards to be very emotional, for a better way to put it. Doesn't mean it's inherent to cards themselves. In my experience, the cards will become what the reader wants them to be in terms of how they interact with them. I do believe that every deck of cards has its own spirit, so to speak, or acquires its own spirit through use. But I think that it has everything to do with the spirit of the person who's using them. We could get into long conversations about the nature of spirit, but that would take us far afield. But there is a theory that spirit is informational in character, that it develops through the acquisition of information. So when I talk about the spirit of a tarot deck, the more it's used, the more spirit it's going to have. The more you interact with it, the more unique it will be. And it will reflect you in a lot of ways because you are what it's learning from. So my cards are always very friendly, very happy to be used. They don't expect silk scarves because I don't have any. They don't expect boxes because I'm not using them. They're very friendly, for want of a better way to put it. They're very accessible. But another person will have a different experience because they have a different way of relating to spirit. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just a different perspective. But as to the person who's learning tarot, does your relationship to tarot have to be that way? Absolutely not. It can be just as simple and friendly as you want it to be, or as complex. And that's true for any spiritual discipline you're going to go into. Some branches of spirituality are so rigid and so full of, you can only do it this way. You mustn't mess up a single word of the liturgy, blah, 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 blah.
Right, right.
For some people, they need that. I totally do not approach spirituality that way. My tradition does not approach spirituality that way. And we get excellent results. But so do the people who do approach it that way. It's a different way of doing it. Neither is right or wrong. But if you ask me, must spirituality be that way? No, it absolutely does not have to be that way. But it can be if you want it to be.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I have infinite number of questions for you. Let me circle back on one final theme for this discussion, because I just have to ask this. I'm curious, as someone that you mentioned that you are a psychic, mm-hmm. you've done clairvoyant readings, and you do tarot. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about the way that those intersect for you, in the sense that I imagine that, you know, as psychic, all of a sudden you do get energy from people as you're reading. You do get messages. You mm-hmm. do hear things. When it comes to how you're interpreting those messages in the context of then someone sitting down and saying, hey, Reverend Don, please give me a reading. How do you feel the need to clear those thoughts? Do you bring them directly into the reading? Because I wonder that with psychics too. I'm going, I have a feeling that the way I open this door is going to give you insight into me that you might just use in the reading. You're not using the cards purely.
That's true.
You're using the 5-minute pre-conversation, which, and of course, that's sort of the, on the flip side, that's the the cold reading school of thought, people that teach cold reading, the ways of how to imitate what a psychic does. That's what they'd say. Yeah, use anything, grab it. From your perspective, and it's totally fair if you use any of the psychic intel you're getting and channeling it into the reading. But how do you distinguish the messages that you're getting that way? Is it actually something you can, are you actually, do you feel the break between what those messages are intuitively? Can you separate those? And have you ever given a reading where you're going, okay, look, I was picking up a whole lot of stuff about your relationship baggage, but these cards are pulling it in a completely separate direction that even my psychic mind wasn't able to pick up on? Well, yeah, I'm sure you've had it all, but I'm curious what are some of the patterns you find as a reader that has abilities in multiple ways?
Well, you know, different people approach these things different ways, so I can only tell you what I do. And the first thing I would say is I try not to have any conversation before I do a reading. It's best if I've never met the person and know nothing about them. Even if, for example, it's a phone reading where I don't see the person, that also can be helpful, because I find those other things a distraction. So for me, it's better not to know anything, because when you know things about the situation, it can warp the message, because you know you have it in your mind. I'm generally pretty good about getting things out of my mind when I do a reading, but I still would prefer not to know. Second thing, for me, when I do a tarot reading, what I do, I always clear and release before and after readings to let go of, to cleanse my energy and let go of anything that shouldn't be there. And I relax my mind and I go into the reading. I do follow the lead of the cards, but it will be influenced sometimes by the feelings I'm getting at the same time. But I don't make a big differentiation between them. It's just a natural flow. And when I do a reading, I'm talking like I'm talking now. And the way that I read, years ago, when I started reading, I used all the traditional spreads. But in the psychic fairs I worked for, they liked the psychics to speak to, they would have them do presentations through the day. And the common presentation was to have a person draw one card or two or three cards and tell them what it meant. And I found that a better way to read, personally. So if I'm reading for you, we'll draw cards through the conversation, and I will tell you what they mean. I don't usually, unless you want to consider a three-card spread to be a big spread, I don't really use spreads. Sometimes cards will fall out on their own. I will incorporate them. And I will follow where the cards lead, but if I'm getting something else, I'll throw it in. But I don't usually make a big deal about, you know, this is coming more clairvoyantly, this is coming out of the picture of the card, because it's all one thing. And I will say I rely more on the meanings of the cards than on the pictures, but other people can be different. So, for example, years ago, I had a technique where I would have four different decks on my table. And this was back in the 80s. And I would ask the client to pick which deck they wanted to be read by. And I wouldn't mention this was part of the reading, because each of those decks had a different meaning to me. If they picked one deck, it meant this is going to focus on finances. If they drew another one, I expected it to focus on romance, etc. I did find that added to the reading, and it's part of the development of the Infinite Tarot. It's part of that idea. But I did not necessarily find my understanding of the cards changed with those different decks. Just where what was the overwhelming energy of the reading. But sometimes, definitely the deck you're using will affect how you interpret the card. Some cards, you know, most decks are clones of the Rider-Waite-Smith. You're not going to find something different in them, because they're all variations of Pamela Coleman Smith's work. But others are very original. And then the card can really affect what you get from it. Particularly certain cards, such as the Emperor card, the Devil card, the Tower card, different people have had very different takes on them. and that will influence how you read. Sometimes also just the emotional feel. I was showing these two cards earlier, but one has a lot of red, one has a lot of blue. That will give you a certain feeling when you're reading them, which may or may not become part of the reading, depending on how the reader relates to their cards. For me, what I do is I let the cards guide me and I just let the energy flow. And so I guess in a manner of speaking, I'm reading the cards. In a manner of speaking, it's a guided clairvoyant reading. It's both at once. But then I find a lot of things are multiple things at the same time once you really look at them.
Yeah. This is so interesting. All of this. I love it. Yeah, Reverend Don, you know what? I mean, look, obviously, everybody needs to go to tarotai.com. Also, if you're interested in sharpening up your psychic skills and metaphysics, witchschool.com, which we'll put in the show notes, as well if you want to learn about Corellianism, Corellian.com. Before we go, tell me this. Because I'm curious, just so I can be aware, and I'm curious for the listeners too, timeline jumping in the multiverse, are there any telltale signs that I have switched into another timeline? Because right now,
oh my goodness, yes.
I'm not sure that I would be aware of that. How could we know that we're stepping into another timeline? What should we look for?
But most commonly, you will not be aware, and people actually do this all the time. They do it unconsciously. But certain things can give it away. Very often, people will think it's a day other than it actually is. You might think it's Friday when it's actually Thursday. This is a sign that you've jumped the timeline and that you've jumped backwards from Friday. Occasionally, it will go the other way as well. If something is different than it's ever been before, probably one of the most interesting signs I ever had. We used to have a headquarters in Hoopston, Illinois. And this was an ancient building from, 1876, I believe. Very old. And we came to this building every day. In fact, we lived in it for a while. And one day, several years in, we noticed this pole in the yard. It looked like it had maybe once been a utility pole of some kind. It was old. It was rusted. We had never seen it before. We asked people that we knew, has this pole always been here? They said, well, yes, it's always been there. We had never had it there. We had jumped the timeline. The building was called the Elephant. So the phrase that goes with this is pole in the elephant yard. But for proof that these things were real, it was very informative for some of our more skeptical people in the office who didn't necessarily have a strong metaphysical background, because not everyone who was with us then did. But it showed, yes, this happens, because that had been a bare yard before. And one day it was just there. Other things like that can happen. You'll sometimes hear people describe them as a glitch in the matrix.
Yeah. But
it can actually be that you've shifted a timeline. And again, people do it unconsciously all the time. Learning to do it consciously is not so easy, but it absolutely can be done. But it's something you want to do with some care, because it can make changes that are unexpected as well as the ones you think you're getting. Because you never know for sure exactly what all will change when you go into that other timeline. And another thing that will sometimes happen when you've changed the timeline is that other people will remember things that happened very differently than you do. They're not necessarily wrong. You're not necessarily wrong. You may have had different experiences based on the timeline difference. The most dramatic thing I've seen is there have been occasions where there were people who I knew had died and they were not dead. They were still living in a timeline that was different from the one I'd been in. And people, when this happens, and this happens to people a lot, they make up excuses for why they're just imagining it. But if you work with timelines, you'll come to find out that very often it's not imagination. You've simply changed a timeline. And it's not an unnatural thing. It's not really a bizarre thing. It's something we do constantly. It's a function of our soul. Because all of these timelines exist simultaneously, and it's a matter of where our point of consciousness is. But these are some of the things that will tell you that you've done it. But most commonly, there'll be nothing seemingly out of place.
The Infinite Tarot, do you think it's going to help them jump to other timelines, or is it just going to help them more accurately reflect the timelines they've already jumped? Where do you think the multiverse in practical day-to-day living is represented through the power of the Infinite Tarot?
Well, the first place it's represented is in understanding the concept that reality is more complex than we think it is. The second part, I think that it is good for showing the complexity of the past and the present, but also the future. And it would depend on the individual reader how much they want to interpret that understanding of changes in timelines, of multiple dimensions, of parallel lifetimes. But if they had a background in it, I would say they could use it quite extensively for that purpose. But if that isn't where your specialty lies, you don't have to. And that's the beauty of the system. It's adaptable to what you need it to be. And I think that all aspects of metaphysics have greater value when they are adaptable to where you are at the moment, as well as where you're going. Another thing about the Infinite Tarot, as well as most anything you're going to say about metaphysics, is what you get from it today may be much smaller than what you'll get from it if you look at it again a year from now or 2 years from now, because there's always more that will unfold as your consciousness expands. Things you'll see you didn't see before, things you'll understand you did not understand before. And in our Corellian tradition, I have encountered a number of people who say they go back and read the degree materials every year or so, because every time they read it, they find there's more there than they had consciously realized. And I think that's true really of everything in life, but certainly of metaphysical practice, that your understanding of it will grow with your use of it. So if you were to get an Infinite Tarot today, you might not use it too much in dealing with the multiverse, but 2 or 3 years from now, you might, as your understanding deepens. So hopefully that's a coherent answer.
I love it. This has been, so many wonderful answers, so many wonderful learnings. I mean, I definitely hope Reverend Don to have you on again and really
I would be very, very happy.
Delve deeper into it. Everybody check out Corellian.com, WitchSchool.com, and most importantly right now, TarotAI.com. The Reverend Donald Lewis, thank you so much for enlightening me today. This has been really an interesting discussion. Makes me want to delve deeper into the tarot. And, any guests that I have on that makes me want to go deeper into the topic, and really, I mean it, is fantastic. So, I'm so grateful that you shared this time with me today and for everything you're doing to bring these topics to the mainstream as well.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
Reverend Don Lewis, you have to support this campaign. Isn't it so cool? I love the idea of these pictures that speak to the subconscious mind. It's the stuff of dreams. Literally. Thank you so much, Ronnie McGilvery, for the theme music. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to follow, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts to help this content get out there. Tarot Cards Against Humanity. You heard it here first.